Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is deputy editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, he's back. Lee takes on the private parking firms dishing out unfair charges and wins, obviously. He'll arm you with the tools to fight back yourself. Also today, what does it take to get on the property ladder? Halifax slashes the minimum deposit needed to buy a new home, but first-time buyers still face big hurdles. With the energy price cap to shoot up again in October, to fix or not to fix? That is the question we ask again. We take a look at the five FTSE companies that have fallen the hardest, and you can bank on Dave. The new This Is Money columnist answers the questions on every small business owner's lips. How can I pass on rising costs without losing loyal customers? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at etoro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, private parking firms. Now, loyal listeners to the pod will be familiar with Lee's bete noire over the years. Just when I thought he'd mellowed against these distributors of many an unfair charge, oh, how wrong I could be. Not once, not twice, but thrice has our Lee taken on and beaten parking charges. Lee, of course, is a consumer giant, a fighter for the little guy and gal, a man who really knows his stuff. But the reality is, more than half of appeals actually win, not diminishing your efforts there, Lee. Which, Lee, says to me that there is really something rather wrong with this system. Because I imagine the ones that appeal are only scratching on the surface that bother. I imagine most people, frightened that it's going to double, don't bother, pay the fine, get on with it. Tell us the problem, Lee, with these firms. You know, what makes a charge unfair? And then we'll go into your story.
Well, Georgie, first off, thank you for that Desert Island disc style intro there. Yep. I felt like, you know, you really pumped me up. That was good. What makes these charges unfair? That if you're a private landowner and you want to have a car park and you want to charge for that car park and you want a private parking firm to get involved and run that car park with terms and conditions, that's absolutely fine. I totally understand that. Right? You want to make money, you want to make sure people are paying to park properly, and the world keeps on spinning. It's a pretty simple concept. However, what makes it unfair is quite often people getting penalized for the most daft reasons and reasons which just don't make any sense, aka you've adhered to the terms and conditions of that car park, and then you get a charge in the post anyway, which brings me on to my most recent excitement with a private parking firm. So wife and I and my toddler were on a nice little day trip in the Essex seaside. Had a lovely time. We'd had a lovely day. We'd rented that beach hut. Perfect. We found some free parking. Excellent. Done. On the way back home, we decided I'd never been to Clacton. Now, I wanted to go and see Clacton. I'm an Essex boy. I've never been to Clacton. So we decided to go, and we decided, and I'll tell you why in a minute, to park in the most central location we could find. Hungry toddler, just wanted to get in, out, done. Quick float around. So I paid more than I usually would to park. I paid £5 for 2 hours. Now, that is not cheap for, you know, Clacton. But I'd had free parking all day, and we were just central, done. Went and typed in the registration plate of our car, which I know the back of my hand, you know it like my PIN, like my mobile number. Did it, paid by debit card, contactless. We lasted about 50 minutes in Clacton. There was an unsavory incident basically involving a pub fight, and we decided to get out of there. So we were gone, and that was it, forgotten. Until a couple of weeks later, I got a charge came through in the post for £60 for failure to pay. And an ANPR camera had taken a photo of the car going in and the car going out with our registration plate. When I paid for parking, I had a little ticket that you put on your windscreen, and I displayed it in the windscreen. Typically, shortly after that trip, we cleared out the car and threw things away inside the car, including things like parking tickets, because you think, what's the point of keeping hold of it, right? But yeah, so I had this charge come through, and as you can probably tell, I was absolutely incredulous. I mean, you know, talk about absolute ridiculousness. You know, I hadn't even stayed in the car park for an hour, as they'd shown me in this timestamp in and out, and I'd paid £5. So immediately, and this is what you need to do in these kinds of circumstances, is make an appeal. There's always an appeal process with the private parking companies. So take it to them first, outline any kind of, you know, why you think it was unreasonable. Never admit to who was driving. You don't need to reveal that piece of information. So for example, in this circumstance, the vehicle is registered in my wife's name. We both drive that car, but it's not necessary that my wife was driving. She just is the owner of the vehicle. You don't admit who's driving.
What does it matter, Lee?
It does, because they can start coming after you more personally if they know who was driving the car. Okay. So usually there's an option when it says who was driving the car, and it says, you know, you don't disclose. I would always pick that option when you appeal. So that's why I won't tell you who was driving. And then basically I'd written to them. Now, luckily, I'd paid by debit card. And I had a payment reference for that £5, which I could find in my banking app. I wrote down the reference. I can't screenshot my banking app because of security reasons. So I just took down the payment reference number and said, hey, I paid for 2 hours. Here's my payment reference. Thought that would be a matter put to bed. I mean, it proves I paid.
Right, yeah.
Did I input the registration plate wrong? Well, I've got no idea. It hasn't told me otherwise. Maybe I did, but it's very unlikely. I mean, I check these things, you know, because I know how these parking operators, you know, go about business. So anyway, that was rejected. Did I have the ticket that I could
rejected
send
on
in?
What grounds? That you might have pressed it wrong, or
wasn't enough proof? It wasn't enough proof that I'd paid for that day and the correct amount. Yeah, I know. It was like, what can't you just
even though account? The time would have been accurate.
Exactly, the time would have been accurate, all of that kind
and
of thing.
And if you were to buy something in store, a receipt or a bank, your bank statement is enough for that proof, but it's not enough for the private parking firms.
Well, it wasn't in
with
this
the
case.
Time on it as well.
Absolutely incredible. So it was rejected, and as I say, I've thrown the ticket away. So I just appealed again and said, look, here's my payment reference. Surely you can put this payment reference to my car. No, rejected again. And if I didn't like it, I could take it to Poplar. Now, Poplar is the independent appeals process. So, of course, straight away, within a couple of minutes of getting that rejection email, I was like, straight on the high horse, straight through Poplar. And I was like, look, I paid for this. I've supplied the payment reference number. I've not really been given any other explanation as to why it can't match this with my parking. It's just unfair. So, a couple of weeks later, got an email from Poplar saying the private parking company has decided to cancel the charge. I mean, what a process, Georgie, for something so simple. How have we allowed parking to become such a cash cow, ridiculous situation in which I'm treated as guilty when I know I'm innocent?
This isn't unfair. This is downright criminal. This is theft. If you'd have paid for it with cash, you would have had no evidence. This is making me feel better about the fact that my car is an absolute tip and covered in parking tickets. What can you do?
Exactly. And then I was starting to worry that the Poplar appeal, you know, would be turned down. And now what I'm doing, Georgie, and this is so sad, I have an envelope in the car. So whenever I pay for parking now, I just put the parking ticket in the envelope just to keep hold of it as proof that I've paid. This ticket was clearly displayed in the windscreen. And that was kind of another argument. I mean, all it's done is taken a picture of my car going in and a picture going out.
Yeah,
so what was the
evidence.
Point of issuing me a ticket? Because, you know, I put it in the car. And this isn't the first time, Georgie, as you mentioned, this is the third time now that I've had to go through this. Really briefly, 4 years ago, my wife got a ticket for parking on a double yellow line in a BP garage outside of Stansted.
For 2 minutes. You telling us on the podcast, Lee.
She was there for 2 minutes. She was heavily pregnant. She'd come to pick me up from the airport and she needed to stop quickly to basically just have a quick stretch. I mean, we don't live far away from Stansted. She timed it perfectly. It wasn't like she was like doing anything like dodgy, like waiting around for ages. She was literally there for a couple of minutes because she was uncomfortable and then came to get me. And they sent that charge was sent through the post far too late. And I argued on those grounds. And the second time was for overstaying at a car park, a supermarket car park, which was a free car park in which we hadn't overstayed. And then, you know, we're customers of this supermarket quite a lot. And it was, again, magically cancelled. So, you know, I think the real thing to remember in these kind of circumstances is to appeal. It's just to make an appeal. Make sure you don't mention who was driving the vehicle, and just anything that you can sort of like muster up. There's lots of good advice also online about how to fight these and how to do it properly and use the right legalese and all of that kind of thing. But yeah, Georgie, I'm quite fed up of it, really. So we've got this parking bill came in. So after that charge a few years ago, we launched a campaign. And actually it was a really good campaign. We had lots of case studies of readers that had written in with all kinds of unfair charges. We had the backing of the AA president, Edmund King. We did everything. We just really threw everything at it. Mm. And then actually we even had a minister write a piece for us saying actually there was going to be a private parking bill coming in that would help stop some of this, including a maximum charge of £50. So at the moment, typically you'll be charged £60 if you pay within 14 days. And that deadline element is what I think freaks a lot of people out. Yeah. They think, oh, 14 days, you know, or, you know, I don't want to, this to then escalate to £100, which is what they threaten you with. I think you've got to keep your cool. You've got to appeal it and go for it. But now this code of practice is now currently on ice. It's been frozen. There's been some backlash from the private parking companies and the association. They're not happy with it. And it's now... it's almost like it's not gone back to the drawing board, but there's no clear indication as to when these better consumer rights are going to come in, which I think is a real shame. And then we talk about things like, you know, the high street struggling, but then you've got people that are just like, you know, do you want to go and park your car and potentially get fined and or get a charge and that kind of thing? And I just think, why have we done this? And then the other part of what I'd written about in this is about these parking apps as well, right? So now, actually, using a parking app can be a little bit convenient because in circumstances like that, you can prove that you've paid. Now, I use one for my local car park here in the town. It's really easy to use. You know,
Ringo, which allows you to pay? Or do you mean like Just Park, which allows you to park in someone else's?
No, I mean like Ringo.
Yeah.
So a lot of, especially councils now. A lot of councils have now gone with these companies. So, for example, one here, it takes 2 seconds. I don't have to have an account. I put in the code of the car park, I put in my license plate, and then I just make a car payment. Now, recently I was up in Suffolk and we were in this car park, and it was really rural car park on the coast. And I went to go and pay by cash, as I usually do, or card. But there wasn't a payment machine. I was like, okay, it's strange. You could only pay by the payment app. Now, this payment app, they're not all built the same. So I'm having to sign up for an account on this one. I've got to have a password. I've got to have my email address. I've got to go and confirm that via my email address, you know, to make sure the account's set up. I've got to tick all these boxes. I don't want to be contacted by third parties, blah, 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 blah. I enter my registration plate. I then put in my bank card details. I'm in a patchy bit of Suffolk, like, you know, I mean, mobile signal is not the greatest where I am, where I was currently doing this. And then as I'm putting the payment through, I then have to go through a two-factor with the bank. So then I have to have another step for £2 worth of parking. £2. Now, while I'm doing this as well, two older people come up to me and say, oh, where do you pay for parking? I was like, well, you know, you've got to do it on your phone. One older couple didn't have a smartphone. Other older couple just sort of went, no, I felt bad. Like it was almost my fault. You know, that I'm the younger generation and I can do all these things. Yeah. I was just as annoyed as they were because it was just a really slow process. And they just drove out of the car park. And I just thought, what is the point of all this? There should always be an option.
Some customers lost for some local businesses there.
That's what I mean. So I just don't understand why we've made it all so complicated.
Money-ly.
Yeah, saving money, and it is, you know, not having to empty those machines. And but even just to offer a card tap, you know, most people are comfortable doing that now, especially for a payment like £2. It's just incredible. And I think we need to really, I think councils and the government need to look at what kind of impact this has, because people just want a simple way to park. They don't mind paying to park if it's a fair price. They just want to make it easy, you know, make it easy to do so. And they don't want to have a risk of constant private parking firms with a constant, you know, scattergun approach of sending out unjust charges, which quite often are just cancelled. And, you know, as you pointed out, a lot of people just won't appeal. They'll see that and go, can't be bothered, or, yeah. or you know, oh, is it worth the hassle? Like, I don't want to end up with a higher fine.
I think one of the reasons people don't, sorry, jumping in there, but one of the reasons I think people don't is because they're worried that if they appeal, then that 14 days starts counting. Does it pause?
Yeah, so it's frozen. You know, you should be able to make that appeal. And then if it's rejected and you go through the popular route, again, it will be frozen until there's a resolution. So, yeah, anyway, if you or someone has had one of these unfair parking charges, you know, we're more than happy to start looking into them again, because we'd kind of paused on it a little bit because I was thinking, well, this bill's coming out. So hopefully there's going to be, we've always just argued for a common sense approach. That's all we're asking for, Georgie, just absolute common sense in a lot of these cases. You know, it shouldn't be that an ANPR camera then just triggers a charge. You know, in the case I've just been mentioning, I mean, it's absolutely incredible. I sort of saw it and I thought, this is a joke. Like, this is just absolutely disgraceful. Like, doesn't the local council not think, wow, like, you know, should this sort of thing be happening? You know, and definitely if this happens to you, contact like local MPs and that kind of thing, because I think there needs to be some sort of movement on this. But you can get in touch with your stories at editor@thisismoney.co.uk and we'll have a look at, and we're collating these again.
Simon, what more should be done here, do you reckon? It's a bit disappointing that ministers withdrew that proposal to lower the amount that private parking firms can charge, don't you think?
Yes, it is hugely disappointing. That is because, quite frankly, private parking charges are a racket. This is a racket being perpetrated on the great British public, for whom it is now almost impossible to stop or park anywhere without fear of somehow ending up with a ticket. I'm probably exaggerating that a bit. You can still stop and park lots of places, but almost every single supermarket, car park, petrol station, motorway service station, pub car park, all of these places are council. You know, when you pull into a park, you know, car park by a park or something like that, maybe you go to a day out or something. Everywhere has these ANPR cameras. And there's a sign up that says, if you overstay, you're welcome. Stay for longer than, you know, however long it is, or you don't buy your ticket, or you do whatever, then you'll be fined. So why this proliferation of this stuff? Because basically the parking companies who run this kind of stuff have gone to the landowners and they've said, see, you've got some parking there. Might be able to make a bit of money out of that. We'll stick the cameras in and we'll stick the signs up. People overstay, they're welcome. We'll send them a fine. To give an example of this, some years ago, at a it's a hotel that's been around for years, just off the A1M in Hatfield, called the Comet, and it's got a car park out the front of it, big car park, right? My mum pulled in there to hand over my children to my wife, basically. So my mum had come from her house. My wife had met her there, coming from London. They met halfway, hand the kids over. My mum pulled into this car park and waited there for approximately 5 minutes, I think, right? The car park was almost completely empty. She was definitely not depriving anybody of a space, because there were many other spaces, unless somebody drove in and wanted that particular space that she was parked in, which is highly unlikely. And if you are one of those people who holds a parking space as your very own and it's not marked as your own, you need to move on. Someone else is going to stop in it occasionally. And she gets a letter through the post a couple of weeks later telling her that she's parked there without, you know, permission, and she's broken the whatever, and the ANPR's caught her, and she needs to pay a £60 fine. £60 just for handing the kids over and stopping somewhere. You've got to stop somewhere, haven't you? And it's better not to just stop in the middle of the road. And it is ridiculous that we have allowed this to happen. The government is desperate, absolutely desperate, for ideas that are going to be popular with people, because the government is really desperate to be popular with people, because it's managed to go from being really, really popular to really, really unpopular in an incredibly short space of time. This would be a really, really good way to get lots of normal people on side to say, enough, okay, we're going to stop this. And the way we're going to stop it is we're not going to let the DVLA facilitate this any longer, because that's what's allowing this, is because the private parking companies go to the DVLA. The DVLA hands over your details, sells your details, in fact. Sorry, I should say hands over your details. The DVLA sells your details, and then they send you the fine. There's got to be a better way of doing this. There's got to be a way of implementing something that means that people can stop, people can park. I mean, I'm thinking of, if I, you know, I could list all of these places that it used to be perfectly possible to just pull into temporarily and then drive out of, okay, or stop momentarily. There's nothing wrong with stopping momentarily. Sure, if it's a really busy car park and nobody can park there because it's full up of people stopping momentarily, or sometimes car parks, you do need to get people to pay. Sometimes people do abuse the generosity of the car park provider. For example, you've got a shopping center, and the shopping center or a supermarket is within walking distance of the station. You can't have people parking there all day long to commute. So you've got to like have some kind of limit. But I do think that it has gone way, way, way too far. And cases like the one that Lee said about his wife pulling into the service station, they're just completely mad and they drive people absolutely crazy. And this helps with the cost of living crisis as well, because let's face it, it would be much better for all of the people who get caught out by one of these fines this weekend to have £60 in their own pocket going towards tackling inflation than for them to give £60 to some private parking company. So there you go. If you're listening, government.
Yeah.
Revive this one. Get back easy on the win. Old parking choice. Easy win. Easy win. It'll make you popular. Just to make another point, right? Yes. There will be many people possibly listening to this thinking, you're so car-centric. Drive everywhere. No, you should be using public transport. You don't need to drive everywhere. Get on, use Shanks's pony, walk, cycle, use public transport. Okay. Well, sometimes you just can't walk places or cycle to them. And the provision of cycle routes outside of major cities is pretty lousy in this country, i.e. getting from one town to another town is nigh on impossible. I mean, for example, there's a cycle route from the town I live in to the next town, but it stops being on the left-hand side of the road at one point and then moves onto the right-hand side of the road on a 60-mile-an-hour road, and there's no crossing. It's like, public transport. Where's the public transport? The public transport does not exist for people to be able to get that bus into town. Those buses just don't exist. They don't run regularly enough and they don't run enough. And actually, I wouldn't mind this racket if all of the money from the racket, instead of going to parking firms, was going into the provision of buses so people didn't have to park.
Yeah, indeed. Look at you two getting all het up. Right. Let's move on from this while we have a bit of a breather. Halifax have announced this week that it's lowering the deposit required to buy new build houses from 10 to 5%. Now, based on the UK's average house price, that could mean just a £14,500 deposit. I say just, but you know, in context, given that putting a sufficient deposit together is often the biggest hurdle first-time buyers face when trying to own their own homes. This looks like, Lee Boyce, great news for first-time buyers. No? Tell us more about the move by Halifax. What does it really mean?
Well, Halifax has had an interesting week, hasn't it? To put it mildly, after the Twitter storm that has blown up. But very, very quietly, the second piece of news of Halifax this week is this 5% mortgage offer on basically new build homes. Now, typically, lenders are a little bit more cautious when it comes to new builds and flats. They tend to, it's that kind of, has it been overpriced? What happens if there was a property downturn? Sometimes new builds flats go down a bit sharper. So there's that kind of element. Now, Halifax have done this, which is possibly good news for first-time buyers, because finding a 5% deposit rather than a 10% deposit typically would mean about £15,000 less to find in terms of the deposit. But as some of the experts have pointed out in this story, there's still the mortgage affordability requirements in order to get onto the property ladder. And actually, with that extra bit of cash, might not necessarily mean you still get the mortgage affordability accessibility part of what you need to get over the line. So while on one hand, it's good that you potentially need a lower deposit, on the other hand, there's still those hoops to jump through to prove that you can afford the monthly payments. And we're at a time, as we've pointed out in this podcast, over the last couple of months, in which mortgage rates have been going up pretty quickly since the end of the year, with base rate hikes, which, you know, first-time buyers haven't been immune to that. You know, and typically first-time buyers have a much higher rate because of the bigger risk that's involved to lenders. So all of those kind of things mean, on one hand, it looks like good news, you know, that you can do this. And there's quite a few providers now. There's quite a few lenders that do offer 95% LTV mortgages. I still think a lot of first-time buyers kind of aim for that 10% to try and get on the property ladder. But we're coming off the back here, Georgie, of two and a half years of house price rises, in which, you know, every month you're putting away some cash potentially as a first-time buyer, only to see another monthly index suggesting
standing that, still, aren't you?
There is a bit of that element. You know, what happens to property prices between now and the end of the year or the end of next year? It's really hard to tell. There's been some suggestions of some cooling off, but I mean, we're cooling off, there's still growth. I mean, that is the long and short of it. And any kind of good first time buyer home, as I think I said on the podcast last week, is getting snapped up like hotcakes, because there are a lot of first time buyers that actually have hit the mark, that are ready to pounce and buy a home. But that supply and demand issue is still out there. And while there are new builds going up, you could argue that there's not enough new builds going up, although some people in certain places would say there's too many new builds going up, but they're probably already on the property ladder. So I think any kind of move like this by a lender, it could potentially be seen as good news, but it's still a massive challenge getting your first home.
Yeah. On the Twitter storm though, Lee, I can't let it go. Sorry. This is about the name badges and putting pronouns on Halifax staff. One, I don't think they've got that many branches anyway. So, but also what I don't really understand is, if you've got name on your badge, why do you need she, her, hers? Because you just go, Georgie over there, call me by my name. I don't need a pronoun, do I? Have I missed that, Lee? I don't understand.
Listen, Georgie, I'm not going to get embroiled in all this. Like, you know, at the end of the day, it's up to
I felt I had to mention it, Lee, in case people are not on Twitter.
But if you're not happy with it for whatever reason, I would just, you know, move bank. There's actually better banks out there offering, you know, cash incentives. And like most people, I think, would argue that they just want their banks to be doing better. They want to be want them to be offering better savings rates. The gap between the 0.25% that Halifax offers on its easy access rate and its 4 point whatever rate on its SVR mortgage has grown since the base rate rises. So offer better rates. And as you say, I mean, Halifax is part of Lloyds. By the end of this year, since 2015, it would have shut 1,000 branches. So, you know, how much longer are branches around to have these pronoun names on is anyone's guess. So, look, I mean, personally speaking, I've kind of become a little bit immune to it because I see it in email signatures and that on Twitter and that kind of thing. And I just kind of gloss over it. It doesn't bother me in the slightest. But, you know, it's up to people. If you're a Halifax,
it seems a bit severe to move your account. Simon?
I don't want to get sucked into this either, right? But I would say for some people, this will be very important. For most people, it doesn't matter at all. It just washes over them. It's like, well, for some people, it'll be very important because they're very anti it. For some people, it'll be very important because they're very pro it. And for the vast majority of people in the middle, it will completely wash over them. They don't care. And they're like, well, Gemma is obviously a woman. But if Gemma wants to be called he, that is totally cool. Okay, then that's fine. Then you should try and call Gemma he. Okay, but and if it goes on a badge, no problems. Whether you should go to war with your own customers on Twitter is another question that I think, you know, I'm not so sure whether you should do, whether that's a good idea. But what I think is most important here is what Lee said, is actually for the vast majority of people who are Halifax customers, there's a very strong chance that they could get a better bank, right? Whether they agree with the pronoun thing, disagree with the pronoun thing, or frankly couldn't give two hoots about the pronoun thing, there is a very strong chance that they could get a better bank. They could possibly get a better current account that will deliver them more perks, work better for them. They could almost certainly get a better savings account. I'm looking at Halifax's page where it offers you the opportunity to compare our best accounts and rates. And if you do compare their best accounts and rates, they don't compare very well with the rest of the market. Their Everyday Saver offers a banging 0.25% interest rate. I mean, wake up, guys. Base rate's 1.25% now. Best Easy Access deal, that'll pay you 1.4%. Okay, you're not going to beat inflation, but you'll be losing a lot less money than you would be if you stick with Halifax. And also, moving on to fixed term savings, their top fixed savings rate is a princely 2%. Sorry, no, I got that totally wrong. Their top fixed rate savings account is a princely 0.8% over 2 years. That's rubbish. Absolute rubbish. So get your money. Move it to someone that pays you a better savings rate. Do not accept the insult accounts that large banks and building societies lumber their customers with. Go move your money to somewhere better, regardless of what you think about pronouns.
Yeah, indeed. And we'll put the pronouns and all that jazz to one side, because Lee, more generally, let's focus back on first-time buyers. And you've been speaking to some aspiring homeowners on your website, four of them, I believe, to kind of get an idea of what it's like nowadays, you know, trying to get that deposit and all that sort of jazz. What have you found out? Anything you didn't expect?
Well, yeah, our reporter, Ed Magnus, went sort of kind of did a, I would call this a deep dive. Am I allowed to say that on this podcast? It's a bit of a sort of journalism cliche, but he did a deep dive on what it takes for people to be saving on a deposit. And actually, what I thought was quite interesting about this piece is quite often as well, you see those other types of Twitter storm, getting a bit media centric here, but when people start reading those stories about how people get on the property ladder, and then there's always that line of, and then of course my parents hold with £50,000, and it's like, okay, you know, that doesn't help people that aren't in that boat. But actually, interestingly, in this story, talking to four different people, we've got someone that is being helped somewhat by their mum. We've got someone in there who's an aspiring solo buyer who didn't start saving for a deposit until the start of the pandemic, where she managed to tuck £1,000 away because she said that actually she was finding where she wasn't going out and all that kind of thing. She managed to save that first £1,000, which kind of inspired her to make her think, oh, hold on a minute, I can do this. And now she's got a £10,000 pot. So fair play to her. You know, it's going to take a little bit more time, but she's got a stocks and shares lifetime ISA. And some of that is government bonus. Some of that would have been a bit of growth, but of course what's happening in the markets at the moment might make that a little bit more testy. But I thought that was, you know, interesting. We've got a couple in there who are 21, and actually, you know, they are so determined to buy a house. They are living in a room in one of their parents' homes, which, you know, if you're able to do that, great. And a lot of people actually under 25 do still live with their parents because of the change of, you know, home ownership. And they've managed to save up £30,000 without parental help outside of staying in the home, you know, which is obviously a massive help because you're not paying rent. But they're scrimping and saving, and they've managed to get that kind of deposit together. And I think it's interesting. And there's a line actually in this, which Ed pulled out. And basically back in 1995, two-thirds of people aged between 25 and 34 owned a property. That has fallen to a quarter. Today's figures. That is quite a start. That's a massive fall in not a huge amount of time. One thing I would say about this is I think that younger people, you know, shouldn't get too het up about getting a property. And that's really easy for me to say because I'm a homeowner, and I became a homeowner just before I turned 30. You know, I rented for a long time. Wife and I saved a lot of money to get a deposit, but I was in a kind of part of my career in which I found it easier to save than when you first start out in a career, especially in a cost of living crisis. It's very difficult. But what I would recommend is having a read of this deep dive story from Ed. It's fairly chunky, I would say. But I think it's quite inspirational, actually, because there's people in all kinds of walks of life. We've got someone else in here who's a little bit older, who's trying to buy their first property. There's people from all sorts of walks of life in there that are trying to get on the property ladder. And I think it's an interesting snapshot of where people stand currently in Britain in terms of trying to get on that property ladder.
Simon?
I think for many people, going back to what we were talking about with Halifax, the issue is the fact that they may be paying rent and that actually they could be paying less on a mortgage if they could buy a property. But the real problem that is always exposed by this, and when you speak to first-time buyers, is the saving a deposit. And if the bank of mum and dad can help, that's great. But if the bank of mum and dad can't help, or if you live in an area of the country where the bank of mum and dad can help, but that is literally a drop in the ocean, then it's a real issue. And you're also then far more likely to be paying very, very expensive rent. So there is, you know, the if you can get onto the ladder with that small deposit, then that looks very, very tempting. But you've got to bear in mind that house prices might fall. You might, your 5% deposit might get wiped out. You might end up no longer having any equity in the property. So you need to make sure that the property you're buying is somewhere that you are happy to live for some years to come. And I think that you need to make sure that the place you're buying, you'd be happy living for the next 5 years. I think it's like investing in the stock market, where they say you need to think long term, you need to think at least 5 years. You cannot rely on the fact that you might be able to sell that property and move into a different one in 2 years' time or 3 years' time. It's too short. And actually, 2 years goes unbelievably quickly. This is something that always gets commented on by people who've taken out 2 year fixed rate mortgages. And they say, I can't believe I've got a remortgage already. I don't know where that 2 years has gone. I moved into my house 2 years ago, pretty much. I can't believe that 2 years has gone that quickly, in all honesty. So, I think that is an issue for people. And then, yes, it seems like a race. It seems like prices are getting further and further away from you. It seems like if you don't buy now, then you're never going to be able to buy. And so you just need to do everything you possibly can and pay what you can and things like that. That's how inflation works. That's how inflationary expectations work. They feed upon themselves. And it's just important to keep your head about you when you're doing it and not get too sucked into that. But I mean, I say that, as Lee commented himself, from the nice position of actually being someone who owns their own home. So, you know, I have every sympathy with first-time buyers who are really struggling. And it's really interesting to hear different people's stories, being honest about how they're doing it, from the I'm having to do it all by myself kind of story to the one where someone's saying, yeah, actually, I'm getting quite a bit of help from my parents.
Mm. Well, I can speak not from the lifeboat of having my own home. I am a renter. I have been saving up. I am in a position where I could. I think a lot of it is just my career took me around. I just was never in a position to think about where I would want to move to. Now I am, though, Lee. The thing that's holding me back is, well, lots of things. I'm the worst procrastinator. I have also a contract currently with my landlord. But that ends soon. So there's no excuse for me, except what the heck is going to happen with house prices, Lee?
Oh, Georgie, that is the crystal ball gazing impossible.
Obviously, but now seems a very, very bad time. Like right at this moment seems a very, very bad time to buy.
You can never time the market. I wouldn't start thinking about timing the market. You know, actually what you want to be looking at is a home that you can buy, that you can grow into, that you're not going to be unhappy in within a couple of years because you've really sort of bought the wrong kind of fit for you. And I think at the end of the day, if the right property comes up and you want it, you go for it. You know, you've got to do your due diligence and all that kind of stuff. I remember I bought this house. I'm doing this very podcast in 6 years ago. Again, like Simon, I don't know where 6 years have gone. I remember having some sleepless nights before the property completed because of the price that we paid for it. And I was like, oh, is this the top of the market? What if this is the top of the market and then everything crashes? And that's because we are, you know, the sort of people that grew up with the financial crisis and saw that negative equity and saw those house price crashes. And I, you know, seeing that massive six-figure sum, you know, then hanging over your neck for a considerable part of your life is quite daunting. Of course, since I've bought the property, you know, house prices have gone up. But more crucially, I'm happy in this house. You know, this is the first time buyer home. When I bought it, instead of buying a two-bedroom flat, we bought a three-bedroom house in a slightly not as good location, but with more space to grow. And then since then, we've had a child, and I'm thankful that we bought this house rather than the smaller flat in a more trendy area, because we've got more space to grow. And that's what I mean about finding the right property at the point of life that you're in, more so than thinking about what if house prices crash between now and next year or the year after. You just can't, it's impossible. You just got to buy a home for what it is, somewhere to live, not somewhere that's just going to keep going up in value. That's my opinion.
Simon, what's your advice to me?
Do you think you're going to stay in the same place?
Never. Simon,
are you done moving?
No.
You done roaming?
I can't help it. I can't help myself. I just can't think of anywhere that I would live for, 2 years for me seems, unlike you, a heck of a long time.
Then perhaps you might be someone for whom renting is a better idea. Because
I'm sinking a lot of money in it, though, aren't I?
You are sinking a lot of money into renting, but you'd be sinking a lot of money into a deposit for a property, and then you have to sink quite a lot of money into maintaining that property, which is the thing that people do always forget, is that running a property does cost money. And so you have to factor that into your costs. Maybe it isn't the right thing for you and you're better off investing that money instead. I mean, the thing is, people say that and then they look at what's happened to property prices and they think, well, if only I'd owned a property. So that is why it's a difficult conundrum for people. But you can't rely on property prices rising at a clip forever. And they are now more expensive than they have ever been when compared to wages. So two things could happen there. Wages could go up or house prices could go down, or they could just stall and wages slowly go up. But, you know, there is that issue to bear in mind.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North of eToro for our weekly look at what's been happening on the markets. Sam, what's been going on over the past week?
Hi, Simon. Yeah, halfway through the year now, which is pretty crazy to say. It was a bit of a busier week, this one, compared to the last. But as we said last time out, the end of the month, end of the quarter, end of the first half of the year, it would always be quite hard to navigate as there would be rebalancing of portfolios, buying and selling of currencies, etc., by these big institutions. And that was the case. Most equity markets are set to finish down, but importantly, they're actually a fair bit off their lows of the week, which is pretty significant. And investors will be hoping and crossing everything that this is a sign of things to come in the second half of the year. Bank of England Governor, he came out and said that they will not necessarily have to act forcefully to get inflation under control. But for me, that sounds like wishful thinking. But fingers crossed, we can start to see improvements elsewhere.
So I'm not going to ask you to predict what we've got coming up over the next 6 months, but what do we know that we've got coming up next week?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing to note is US bank holiday on Monday. So July the 4th, of course, is Independence Day, and therefore markets will be super quiet, even though they are open elsewhere. From a UK perspective, it's actually relatively quiet again, but with the FTSE outperforming pretty much every other, top stock market this year, that could be another benefit as there's no new bad news that might help it push it on. Inflation isn't for a while, GDP isn't for a while. We've just got some services and composite and manufacturing PMI data, which is important in its own right, but probably not going to be massively market moving. Elsewhere, we've got Reserve Bank of Australia interest rate decision. We've got the minutes from the last Federal Reserve meeting. And on Friday, we've also got the latest jobs numbers out of America to navigate through the back end of that week.
Okay, great. Well, we will catch up with you in a week's time. Hopefully we'll have had another half decent week.
Fingers crossed, Simon. Thank you.
Thanks, Sam.
Welcome back. Now, you have a new series on This Is Money, where you set out to answer your burning money questions. Not your burning money questions, the reader's burning money questions. And where else to start but energy deals? To fix or not to fix? With bills set to soar again in October, Lee Boyce. We've asked this question before. The answer's always been no. But what about now? Is it time to lock into a deal?
I'll just quickly point out that this big money question is part of our sister publication, The Financial Mail, on Sunday.
Oh, yeah, it's fine.
However, it does have roots in This Is Money, because Rachel, who has started this, obviously used to work for This Is Money. So I thought I'd just point that out.
Tomatoes, tomatoes, Lee. It's on This Is Money, you're going, therefore we're owning it. It's fine. Well done to Money Mail, all that jazz. But and Rachel, who is a fabulous journalist, and once of this parish and this podcast. Anyway, Lee, on to the important question. That is not the burning issue. The burning issue is, should we fix?
The real short answer to this is probably not, right? Because at the moment, if you're on a variable tariff, we've got a situation in which in October, the estimates now is that the energy price cap is going to go up to £3,000. Energy firms, unless you can get a fix underneath that level, it's going to be very unlikely that it's going to pay you to fix, because the next set of price cap, the estimations are that it's going to be a much slower increase than this leap. So the leap that we had in April and the leap that we're going to get in October have been potentially going to be massive. The leap between October and next year, the forecasts are it's going to be nowhere near, you know, those kind of jumps. So the number of fixes that are out there are few and far between. I've heard rumors of a few energy companies sticking a few fixes out here and there that are underneath the potential new price cap coming in October, but they've been pulled off sale pretty quickly, suggesting people are hot off the mark to take these. But unless you're finding something under that £3,000 figure, it probably isn't going to pay you to switch to a fix.
Simon, are you in agreement with that?
Broadly speaking, yes. I think that the issue for most people is, do you fix and overpay until the price cap comes in? Because almost all of the deals that you fix with, you are going to end up doing that. Or do you stick with what you've got on the price cap? And I mean, I must admit that I'm stuck on the price cap, because the idea of overpaying until the energy price cap goes up is a false economy to fix. And the fixed rate deals that I have managed to have a look at the last time around when I did this, and I have recently done this again just to have a quick check again, are way, way more expensive than I would be paying on the price cap. So it is a really tricky one. If you suddenly find a really good fixed rate deal and you do the numbers and you work out that the amount that you're going to overpay before the price cap goes up doesn't outweigh it and so on, and you're really concerned about it, then maybe yes, do it. Watch out for charges to leave the deal though, because if all of a sudden energy prices drop and you realize that you've locked into overpaying, then you might think, I need to get out of this. But if you're going to be charged hundreds upon hundreds of pounds for doing so, and then that's going to nullify all of the savings you'd make, then you might end up kicking yourself.
Right. Investors. Let's go there now. It's been a tough year so far for investors. The FTSE 100 down 4.4% since the start of 2022. But these five companies I'm about to mention have seen investors head to the exit faster than any other. Ocado, JD Sports Fashion, Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, Royal Mail and Ashtead Group are the FTSE 100's worst performers in the first half of 2022, each falling more than 40%. But why? And we asked it last week generally, so let's ask it specifically now. Should you tuck into those shares or leave them well alone? Simon, what is going on with those particular companies? Is there a general theme to these five or something more specific to each?
I don't think there is a general theme to these five, other than that the inflation spike, interest rates going up much faster than people expect, concerns about recession theme has hit them all like it has hit many other things in the market. I also think the other element to bear in mind is that these are all stocks that had gone up a lot before they then fell a lot. So those are maybe the two things that link them up. But that's also true of many other companies. And then each of these has its own company-specific problem. Ocado shares are down 54%. So bearing in mind what I just said, inflation, recession, rates, gone up a lot beforehand. Okay, just take that as a given. Why Ocado? Well, Ocado is regularly referred to as the classic jam tomorrow company. You buy into Ocado because you believe that in the future, Ocado is going to be absolutely raking it in, because it's not a online grocer. It's a technology company. It's a platform. It's robot warehouses. It's rolling that out to other companies and then getting paid for it. It's the intellectual property that comes with that. But it does cost money to do this stuff. And Ocado has a habit of burning through investors' cash. In fact, it's just announced that it needed to raise some more money because it had been burning through so much. And so people have gone, well, hang on a minute. Maybe we got a little bit ahead of ourselves with our expectations for Ocado, and the shares have sold off quite heavily. Are they now cheap enough to buy back into and decide that that jam tomorrow is actually now jam that's a discounted enough price that you are willing to pay some money for someone to come around and stick it in your cupboard in a couple of years' time? Maybe, maybe not. That's up to you to decide. Shares still look quite expensive, but maybe justifiably so. Who knows? They're cheaper than they were. JD Sports. Now, this has been described as cheap by analysts at Peel Hunt, who have placed a buy rating on the retailer with a price target of £2.50. Bearing in mind the shares are currently trading at £1.17, it's quite a lot higher. Just because a broker says that does not mean it's going to happen. There are many, many broker notes that put price targets on companies that look amazing. And you read the broker note and it's phenomenally convincing. But do bear in mind that there are many of these where it just doesn't happen in the end. It's had its own problems, corporate governance issues. Longtime boss Peter Cowgill had to be got rid of in May after an internal review found failures in internal governance and controls. Had problems with the competition regulator alongside Foot Asylum and so on and so on. But business has been doing very, very well. And in its most recent results, it said this whole athletic leisure trend, I don't know whether it used the word athletic leisure, whether that just got reported. Basically, people wearing sportswear has been doing very well for it. But it said that the whole inflation, supply chain issues, etc., is going to bite. Is it too cheap? Is it too cheap to ignore? Who knows? Make up your own mind, as I said. Scottish Mortgage invests, it's an investment trust, invests in lots of disruptive growth companies. It invests in like 100 jam tomorrow companies. And did very, very, very well as everybody was believing that purchasing jam to arrive at some point in the future was a spectacularly good idea. People's minds have changed now. If you believe that Scottish Mortgage has a really good management team who have the ability to spot these good companies and takes a portfolio approach to it, whereby they know that many of those will fall by the wayside and not achieve their promise, but the ones that do achieve their promise will achieve their promise so well that the amount of jam being rammed into your cupboards will make up for all of the people who never delivered you any jam, even though they promised to, then Scottish Mortgage is a good investment. Don't put all of your money into it, okay? Because it is high risk, it is volatile. But the managers tell you that. They warn you. They warn you about this stuff. Sometimes people don't pay enough attention to those warnings. But those shares are down by a lot, 46% over the past 6 months. It's a big question for investors. Is this an opportunity or not? Royal Mail, again, a company with its own legacy problems that we all know about, but that has been doing very, very well off the parcels boom. We talked about this last week. Shares had done spectacularly well. Shares have done down spectacularly badly over the last 6 months, down 50%. What do you think? How's Royal Mail going to play out? That's what you have to decide. Can somebody else do this? You know, are we hooking too much on this whole delivery boom? Who knows? Ashtead's a really interesting one. Ashtead's a bit of a profit machine. It's an industrial equipment rental company, largely operates in the US. This is all about recession fears. Okay. It had seen business boom in the pandemic bounce back, renting out equipment. And now there's real worries that an inflation interest rates driven recession is going to massively impact its business. And it's going to see its revenues decline substantially. Has it been oversold? Potentially some of that comes off the back of the fact that it had done so well before that. The share price had done spectacularly well before it started falling. Is there going to be a massive construction slowdown in the US? Possibly not. Is it an opportunity? As I said, you have to make up your own mind on these things.
God, you're so annoying, Simon.
Punchline
to like, every one of those.
It literally is, though. It's like if you're going to buy individual company shares, you need to take responsibility for researching that company properly yourself. Mm. Otherwise, go buy yourself an investment fund or an investment trust or just a tracker where you just follow the market. If you're not willing to take responsibility for making your own decision and for researching the shares properly, don't buy the shares.
There you go. Just one question about Royal Mail. You were mentioning about whether you think that the online delivery boom will continue. Are there other companies that can do as well? Was that the reason why the shares have sunk so much? Because people don't believe that?
No, I think they just got ahead of themselves with believing it. It's a known thing. I don't know. There is that thing where it also has to deliver all those letters. That's not a very profitable part of the business. And that is in structural decline. People send less letters nowadays. So can the parcels overtake that? I mean, Royal Mail comes to my house about four times a day at the moment. You know, on the days that I'm at home, these guys are constantly coming around. So there's definitely something going on. Is it making enough money out of that? Who knows?
We shall find out, I suppose. Any general lessons to be learnt here, Simon? I feel like I should ask you that.
Stuff goes down as well as up.
Obviously, that's a lesson. Anything else useful?
Stuff that goes up a lot can go down a lot.
Yeah. Okay.
Don't put all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah, like that.
If you only held these five, you'd be hurting at the moment.
Yeah.
Do you want any more truisms?
I just thought maybe there was something else that we could throw in there that was useful, but...
Don't expect what has done really, really well over the past 5 to 10 years to be the same stuff that does really, really well over the next 5 to 10 years, because things have definitely changed. We are not in the era of low inflation and super low interest rates and holding on to those two things as a given anymore. We are now in an era of high inflation and rising interest rates. Interest rates may yet fall again and they may stop rising, and inflation may come down much quicker than we think. But we are definitely in a different world to the one that we spent the last decade in.
And what businesses do well in that world, Simon?
Very difficult to tell, to be honest. There's the suggestion that businesses that are not super highly valued will do well. But in terms of their actual business model, businesses that deal in real assets can tend to do well in that kind of scenario. But it's also equally possible that these disruptive companies might do very well as well. I mean, like stuff like the healthcare sector, you know, biotech and stuff, this is changing dramatically. And also, you know, the digital transition is well underway, you know, obviously. We run a website, we're talking on a podcast, all those other things. But there's much further for that to run. And we focus on the consumer element of that. What you need to think about is actually the business element of that, the industries and how industries and businesses are going to change with this increased, you know, digital adoption and stuff like that. And also at some point, some of the stuff that's done really, really badly in the last few years, because it's been absolutely hated, is going to start doing better again. But you'd have to be a brave person to buy airline shares at the moment.
See, Simon, I knew you had it in you there. Finally, you can bank on Dave. The new This Is Money columnist, Dave Fishwick of Bank of Dave fame, answers your small business questions. Now, this week, a toughie, but really relevant. How do I best pass on price rises at my small bakery to a loyal customer base without losing them? Lee Boyce, that must be a question on the lips of many a small business right now, struggling in the face of the cost of living. When we talk about cost of living, of course, we focus a lot on consumers, but small business particularly suffering badly.
Yeah, exactly, Georgia. I mean, there's so much in terms of overhead rises. You think about staff wanting to be paid more, thinking about energy bills, the cost of fuel, shipping costs, raw materials costs, all those kind of things are just going up and up and up. And I would argue that the majority of businesses are having to put prices up in order to continue to make profits. You know, at the end of the day, business owners are there to make profits. And it's a very difficult, world out there at the moment. And actually, I was even speaking to the local owner of a coffee shop here that I go to fairly regularly. He'd put the prices up earlier in the year, and he's fearful that he's going to have to put prices up again. And then what happens? You know, people potentially start cutting back on having coffees and having sweet treats and that kind of thing, because it's non-essential items, which is what this person who's written in is kind of alluding to in this. So essentially, Dave's advice is just his real takeaway advice from this is just to be as open and honest with customers as possible. And especially if you are someone with a little customer base and you do sort of chat to people, he says here, and I'll quote, "Long after the price is forgotten, the service and quality of the product or produce will be remembered. You cannot consistently beat your large competitors on price. However, you can beat everyone with your service. So always play to your strengths and give the best, most friendly service possible. Always remember, a smile and a chat with your customers costs nothing but are worth a fortune." Now, I think that's really good advice, especially someone, a small business owner, if it is something like a cafe or you've got a small shop, independent shop, typically your prices are higher than, you know, retailers that you've got up and down the country everywhere. And to be a successful local business, perhaps you've just got one store, perhaps you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, something like that, quite a small business, is to have, you know, that kind of intimate, not like too intimate, but you know what I mean, like customer base in which, you know, you do catch up with people and you do kind of say, look, I've had to put prices up. You know, you might notice that your coffee's gone up 20p, but there's absolutely nothing I can do about it. You know, and I think, yeah, the majority of people know that prices are increasing. You know, the cost of living crisis has dominated the news this year. And if you are someone that does offer that great service and a good product, people will continue to pay that slightly higher price. It's not easy. It's not easy being a small business owner at the moment. And it is not easy passing on price increases. But, you know, the majority of businesses are having to do it. If you are a small business owner or you're someone that's looking for perhaps some career guidance or something like that, you can write to Dave at bankondave@thisismoney.co.uk and he'll answer as many people as he can. He's very infectious. He's very like a positive outlook kind of guy. And he always has sound advice. He's been a businessman for a very long time. He's a self-made millionaire. You know, and Netflix don't make a movie about your life if you're not doing something right. So definitely write to him and get in touch, because he really does want to help people.
Thank you very much, Lee. Thank you very much to Dave. Thank you, Simon. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at thisismoney.co.uk. Sorry, you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our pod, and if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too. There are urgent questions on the minds of business leaders today. What will the economy look like in 6 months? Is the metaverse real or just hype? How can companies retain quality talent? How can a culture of creativity unlock innovation? In candid conversations with experts, we answer these questions and more on our podcast, The So What from BCG. Join me, Georgie Frost, as I tap into strategies that can be used today to prepare for tomorrow. Tune in to The So What from BCG wherever you get your podcasts. There are urgent questions on the minds of business leaders today. What will the economy look like in 6 months? Is the metaverse real or just hype? How can companies retain quality talent? How can a culture of creativity unlock innovation? In candid conversations with experts, we answer these questions and more on our podcast, The So What from BCG. Join me, Georgie Frost, as I tap into strategies that can be used today to prepare for tomorrow. Tune into The So What from BCG wherever you get your podcasts. There are urgent questions on the minds of business leaders today. What will the economy look like in 6 months? Is the metaverse real or just hype? How can companies retain quality talent? How can a culture of creativity unlock innovation? In candid conversations with experts, we answer these questions and more on our podcast, The So What from BCG. Join me, Georgie Frost, as I tap into strategies that can be used today to prepare for tomorrow. Tune into The So What from BCG wherever you get your podcasts. There are urgent questions on the minds of business leaders today. What will the economy look like in 6 months? Is the metaverse real or just hype? How can companies retain quality talent? How can a culture of creativity unlock innovation? In candid conversations with experts, we answer these questions and more on our podcast, The So What from BCG. Join me, Georgie Frost, as I tap into strategies that can be used today to prepare for tomorrow. Tune into the So What from BCG, wherever you get your podcasts.